Okay, now I understand Rick Youngberg and his girlfriend ran into some trouble with the Canadian officials.
Well, they did. I guess they were at a party and somehow there was some problem and they were asked about their status there. Maybe Bob can correct me on that.
What had happened is my friend that I had first met the Paisleys with lived around the corner from them. And Rick was a frequent visitor there. And my buddy and his roommate were getting busted, to be quite bluntly. And Rick walked in. And right away the officials wanted to know who he was, where he was from, and what was he doing there. And I felt really bad for Rick when I heard this because I know he was just panicking. So they were told they had to leave the country. And so they did. So it ended up with just Bill and myself staying in Vancouver. And Bill wrote Smoky Windows and a couple of other tunes. And I just worked out the arrangements with him, with the rhythm. And in February, we drove back from Vancouver together.
Okay, so you're all back here, and now you've got a new guitar player at this time too, right? Because Rick leaves the band?
Yeah, well, Rick was playing in a trio at the time. I'm not sure the name.
Cottonwood,
okay. And he didn't want to leave that band to rejoin the Paisleys. So Bill and I were living in St. Paul near Hamlin College, and we put up some posters, got the word out that we were looking for a guitarist. And so Brad answered the call and came and auditioned, and he knew everything, every lick that Rick ever played. He copied him to a T. And the only problem with Brad was he wouldn't turn his amps up, believe it or not, a guitarist that didn't want his amp turned up. And
that's kind of unusual, isn't it?
It's a rarity, yes.
Now, I understand Brad Stotten was from Whitefish, Montana.
That's right, yeah.
And he was a student at Hamlin.
He had just graduated.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're still in there. Is this the early part of 69 now?
This was a spring, wasn't it, Dick? I think like March.
You know, I'm fine.
I think it was March or April when Brad joined us.
Now, does this version of the band go back to Dania Hall?
We played a lot of jobs in Dania Hall after we picked up Brad.
And this is with Richard, your brother, is booking the band now?
Well, at one time, yes. My older brother, when he found out that I actually had a band and we were trying to get some gigs, he did have a production company on his own, William Tim III Productions. So he tried to, he said, maybe I can get you guys some gigs. So he became our booking agent manager for a time. When we came back from Canada, Paul George stayed in Canada. So Paul did not come back at that point. So at that point, I believe that's when my brother tried to book us. But I think he ran into some problems because we were so uniquely different and were being categorized in this cliche of, they're a psychedelic band, they're a love band, they're a hippie band, they're all this. And some of the places he'd been doing business with weren't hiring groups like that.
Yeah, that was a pretty difficult job for Bill.
Yeah. So eventually he just admitted he couldn't really book us. So,
could you kind of describe the scene at Dania Hall? What was it like to be there?
Well, in the early days, it was a place just preserved and presented for this whole movement in music at that time on the West Bank. We were just part of a bigger movement. And, you know, it was on the third floor. It was an old dance hall building that goes way back to the Danes, built it back in the turn of the century. That whole Cedar Avenue used to be known as Snooze Boulevard. And snooze, that was some kind of Scandinavian snuff, I guess. So that's where they would go down to get their snuff, you know, or their chewing tobacco, as the other case was. And it was a hodgepodge melting pot because it was on the west bank of the university. And at that time, there had been this new bridge built across from the west bank to the east bank. So now students could cross the Mississippi on this bridge. And, of course, all the strikes and all the student protests were going on in those times. And the West Bank was kind of like the social center. Gosh, we used to get all kinds of people down there at Dania Hall. Phil Richter, the guy that owned the store, he had a pharmacy, a drugstore on the main floor. And he was just, oh, this is great. He had never seen anything like this. Who are hippies? What's a hippie? You know, all this color suddenly erupted on the whole avenue. And then you had the mom and pops and the kids from the suburbs driving down, gawking at all the hippies. And, oh, what's going on here? And it just became a very colorful, exciting time. We were so engrossed in it. The Dania Hall had all these dances. We could put our own dance on. We could charge our own money if we wanted to charge money. We had full rein to do what we wanted.
What other bands did you see perform at Dania Hall?
I think the first band I see now down the street from Dania, going back to my university days, I was my family. We were caretakers at a building a half a block away from Dania Hall, and so I would hear this music coming out of this place up here, Dania Hall. What the hell's that? Whoa, so I kind of checked it out. And the bands that were playing there off and on were groups like a band called TBI, a band called Noah's Ark. A lot of those guys apparently were from Winona area down southern Minnesota. They all went kind of on to play a lot of different music up and down the avenue. Some of them were folkies because there were folk houses in the area. There was so much activity going on. So as far as the other bands playing up there, there were just a lot of them. I wasn't able to see many of them because I was always playing somewhere. So I don't remember too many bands, but I would imagine all the underground type bands had probably played there at one time.
Was Dania Hall a place where drug use was evident?
Define your term drugs. What kind of drugs were you referring to?
Were drugs an influence on the bands and the audiences at Dania Hall?
I would say there were certain drugs that had a positive influence. Most of those drugs did have a positive influence. There was the only problems with drugs in those days, really, that I saw was maybe somebody too drunk. Alcohol was always the big problem. I don't think the hard drugs like heroin and all that stuff had moved in yet. No. There wasn't this cocaine thing. There,
no.
It was psychedelics were acceptable. LSD, mescaline. Eventually, something called MDA, methethyldiamphetamine, came in, kind of a, they used to call that the love drug. That was an amazing drug.
Marijuana was popular then?
Oh, yes. Oh, and, yeah. And of course, yeah. Smoking herb was always acceptable in most, mm-hmm. most of those circles, and also led to much social intercourse between people. Oh, yeah, man, you got any money? Got any bud, man? You know, yeah, I'm looking, you know. Sure, yeah, get over here, you know. So all these activities, people on the street, learning to be sociable, giving each other the peace sign, promoting peace amongst each other. A new phenomena. Never saw this when I grew up anywhere. It was exciting times.
You know, the thing with marijuana back then, too, that I remember distinctly is that if you had it, you shared it. There was no hoarding. So if someone would come to Daniel Hall and listen to the band, and they would, if they had a joint, they would share it with their brothers and sisters around them. And that was not just to Daniel Hall. That was the culture at the time. And so there was, you know, a lot of people were trying it for the first time back in the 60, 67, 68, 69. So, there was probably some sharing going on at Dania. But when we were gigging, I don't remember looking out at the crowd that much. My focus was on the bandmates and having fun, just playing music with the guys, you know. So if it was out there, evident, I might not have seen it, but I'm sure it was there.
And Richard, you've talked to me before about this concept of expanding your consciousness through music and through hallucinogenic drugs.
Yes, it had a profound effect on me. Mm-hmm. I mean, anybody who knows me knows how far out I am. I mean, you know, yeah, I went crazy, man. Yeah, I went crazy on all these drugs, absolutely, you know. But I made it through all that stuff. And I do, in retrospect, think and believe that those, we always felt we had the teachings to go along with the use of these powerful mind drugs. We were cognizant of Timothy Leary and the pioneering work that these early Harvard psychologists did in mind expansion. When they started taking LSD, they had no interpretation to fit what they were going through. So they, being experimental psychologists and academicians, they tried everything to experiment with these new drugs. And thankfully, they did. Unfortunately, society never took their teachings to heart. They made it illegal. Well, let's stamp it out, you know. If things would have been different, who knows? We'd probably have you know, safe places to go now where people could take their dose of LSD or mescaline or, you know, some derivative. And the psychologists and healers would be allowed to use these things in a healing therapeutic capacity rather than having their hands slapped and, no, you can't do this. And there was so much sensationalism against these drugs. Actually, out and outright lies for the most part.
Yeah.
How do you rectify a lie? Well, the only thing that'll change a lie is the truth. And the truth is hard to come by when you're being told that it's bad. And maybe in some cases it was bad. And there were people that did freak out. And there were people that had bad trips. And there were people that probably don't even remember what they did.
You know, in 68 or 67, excuse me, in 67, I had the opportunity to work on a yacht in Canada. And Cary Grant came on the yacht. A lot of stars came on. Bob Hope would come every year and stuff like that. People like that. And this Cary Grant came on for a 5-day cruise. And working on the yacht, you don't go back and mingle with the guests. But the captain called me up and said, I want you to go and fish off back aft and keep Mr. Grant company while the rest of them are out water skiing and so on and so forth. So I found it this is very odd. So I did. And talked with Mr. Grant for a few hours and then got called back up to get supper ready for the guests. Came out about a week or two later in the news that Cary Grant was using LSD under doctor's care. And this was what the captain was concerned about, because he had the notion in his head that LSD was a drug that would make a person go nuts, when in fact it was being used just the opposite, to help calm people down that had seizures, etc. But, you know, there was a lot of misconceptions about LSD.
Okay. Now, Bob, how long did you play with the Paisleys?
I joined the Paisleys in the summer of 68. And in October, I moved back to Canada of 69, excuse me. So I was with them for about 14, 15 months.
Okay. So Bob exits the band, and I understand you pick up a new drummer. And who's that?
Michael Cornelius.
How'd you find him?
We found him through our good friend and equipment manager, Clancy Cullen. Clancy was from that area. He knew Michael and a lot of the folks from that era, and that's how we found Mike Cornelius. Mike was 16, I believe. He was still a senior in high school. Well, so he couldn't stay out very late, nor could he play, the clubs at night and all that. And so eventually we started rehearsing over at Mike Cornelius's place.
Where was his place?
And his dad had this mansion on Lake Calhoun. Was the Cornelius Company, was his dad. And his dad was fairly well-to-do. I believe now that the Cornelius family elders have passed on, that house is now called the Bakken Museum of Electricity. I believe that's what it's still called. But it was a very unique house, and we used to rehearse there in the basement. And Mike's dad would bring out all these rare artworks and artifacts that he'd collected over the years. And so we kind of took a back seat for a while, not gigging very heavy because of Mike's involvement still in high school. And his dad wanted to keep us, not having his son out playing late at night and then suffering his schoolwork. So
now this version of the band, Richard Tim, bass guitar, Bill Smith, keyboards, Brad Stodden, guitar, and Mike Cornelius, drums. Who was doing the vocals?
All of us did the vocals. When we would write a song, usually the author of that lyrical structure would be the lead singer. So if Bill wrote a song, normally he would be the lead singer on that song. If I wrote a song, then I'd kind of be the lead singer. And then we would all do harmonies behind, whether it was Brad and I behind Bill, or Bill and Brad behind myself, or if we were doing back with Rick, it would be the same. If Rick had written the song, we would back Rick up. And, you know, as creative people, gosh, I'm amazed at all the creativity that did come through the Paisleys.
Now, I understand the summer of 1969, there were quite a few of the Love-In concerts around town. Do you remember where those were held?
A lot of them were held downtown, right on the mall. Some of them were held over at Loring Park. Some were held out there at anywhere from Stevens Square over to the Art Institute Park there. The university down on the river, Riverside Park, had a lot of them.
Did you mention Powderhorn already?
I did not mention Powderhorn yet, but Powderhorn was another one.
Yeah, that was another.
Well, I did mention Powderhorn earlier, when I described the largest circle dance that I had seen. happened there.
And these were called love-in concerts because why?
Because we were promoting love. That was the byword of the day. Love your brother, love your sister. Not hate them. It was multicultural. It transcended the races. I don't think there's been a larger movement on the planet in modern times than really what erupted ever since the late 60s.
Now, looking at my notes, I do see the Paisley's opened up for Santana at New City Opera House on October 16, 1969. I'm assuming that's when you were being booked by Marsh Productions.
That's correct.
I probably believe that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because we hooked up with Marsh. Bill and I got back from Vancouver, and Bill, Dick's brother, couldn't book us. I was having difficulty booking us. We went down and talked to Marsh, and I believe Ralph Trafficante from Trafficante Music in Midway, I believe he set up a meeting, and everything clicked. Our personalities clicked with Marsh. He definitely clicked with us, and he started booking us, and
Now you, Bob, are playing drums for this gig at the with Santana?
No, I went back to Vancouver on October 7th of 69, and was supposed to come back on the 10th for rehearsals, and I ran into immigration issues.
Oh, so you were planning to come back to?
Planning on coming back. You bet, but. I was married to an American and I was a Canadian. So they looked at that rather cross-eyed at the border and wanted to know more and more. And so we decided to stay. I had to give up the jobs that we had lined up. Santana, Joe Cocker. There was a couple others. I can't remember who they were. But Michael got to play those jobs. I envied him for that.
Okay. Also in my notes, I'm showing October 69 that the Paisleys had played a job at the Red Baron in downtown Minneapolis, and there was a fire, apparently, and all your equipment was destroyed.
Was it called the Red Baron then, or was it the office?
I know we played the Red Baron a number of times.
Well, when that Red Baron went out, then it became the office.
That could be.
Yeah, it was across from the Fauché Tower is what I remember. We were booked in there for a Friday and Saturday night. We did the Friday night gig. We left all of our gear set up on stage. Lo and behold, we get a call the next day. Oh, there's been a fire and everything is burnt up. We went down there and looked and it was just charred, just charred.
You know, when I got wind of the fire, I cried because the drum set was actually Greg Payton's drums, and they were beautiful, beautiful drums. They had a great sound, and Michael was using them as well, and so they were lost in the fire.
And I believe you had, Trafficante had insurance on the Marshall amps?
Yeah, all the Marshall amps that Trafficante Music had provided for us. He was our mentor. They were all gone. And of course, he had those insured, so there was some insurance collection for the Marshalls. But all of Brad's gear was his own, and it was all custom made, and he lost everything. So he never did recoup from that fire.